Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com. Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's hear it for our super producer, Max the Ref Williams.
The incorrigible.
The incorrigible.
Max Williams. You guys know I absolutely, with all passion, hate refs and umpires. Like, I'm waiting for technology to make them, like, irrelevant, right?
Wait, what's the one where you're like, underwear snitcher? No, that's pitcher. But there are various rhymey kind of ways of maligning the ump.
Oh, yeah,
as well,
yeah.
I hate them so much.
It seems like a dangerous
game. Well, but do you not acknowledge that they're necessary?
They serve a purpose?
I mean, I'm waiting for their purpose. I mean, I baseball umpires are the worst ones. Their purpose, they believe, is for everyone to watch them.
We're
the star of this show. No one else take away from us. Watch us, which they're just, you know, they take away from the game.
They're an officiant.
Did something happen? Yeah, who hurt you, Max? Kid?
Were
you attacked by a Foot Locker employee?
Diaz, Brian Onora, who, funny note for anyone listening to this, Brian Onora is currently under investigation for soliciting a prostitute, as in he got caught by the FBI for soliciting a prostitute.
Okay. Sex worker, if you will.
Yeah, so
I'm just saying what the FBI said in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay, well, before you introduce those guys, before you introduce those guys, let us introduce ourselves.
Yeah, I'm Ben. I'm Noel.
You're Noel. This is part two of what is becoming an increasingly spicy series.
Very spicy.
History of basketball.
A lot of hot takes and tangents.
Dribbling is amoral.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Really, I'm serious. You know, I'm the first to admit that I am not a big sports guy, but I always have always found basketball to be the most enjoyable and watchable of all of the sports. And the history of it is just as enjoyable and listenable, you know, and I think you guys are going to enjoy this part too a lot. So as we know, basketball became kind of a big deal, and it happened relatively quickly. I believe the first public game was played in a YMCA gym and was recorded or reported on by the Springfield Republican, and that was on March 12th of 1892. We had around 200 folks show up to watch the game, despite having never heard of it before and not having previously existed. We don't have enough of that, man. We don't have, like, a new sport. Like, ooh, you guys hear about the new sport? That'd be cool. I might get in on that, you know, like rollerball or, you know, like the running man. That'd be cool.
I love the idea of new sports being invented. There are a lot of quirky ones.
Is big. It's not new, but it's achieved insane popularity in the last handful of years. But I think it is sort of a newish game. It's styled on kind of, it's like a full court version of ping pong, isn't it?
You could go in the other direction. You could say that pickleball is to tennis what putt putt is to golf.
There you go.
You know, and I say that because a good friend of mine who actually listens to Stuff They Want You Know is a retired Marine who is now a tennis coach. Mm. He's the coolest dude. I met him just because we hang out at the local pizza place, and he's got some hot takes. You dig him. But he hit me up a few months ago, actually, because he teaches tennis, and he's furious about the rise of pickleball. And he'll hit me up and he'll say,
stealing my thunder, man.
He's like, Ben, well, because he teaches pickleball too. And he's like, these people have no respect for the game. It's just a bunch of fucking pickleballers out here. And I'm like, wow, you're...
Beep.
Thank you.
Did you hear that pickleball has become so popular that it's a lot of these dead malls that are like big box stores are being converted into pickleball arenas? I mean, it's solving a problem, I guess, because what else are they going to do with those things?
Yeah, there are a lot of parody songs about it. NPR did a great piece on it where they talk about pickleball parody songs. Mm. It's very strange. Of those.
There was like a limited run, maybe it was a YouTube series, but starring Paul Scheer and his wife, June Diane Raphael. That was like, you know, a lot of those like Lonely Island kind of adjacent LA comedian folks. Or what was it? Human Giant, some of those guys.
Oh, I love those guys.
Yeah, there's like a you know, sort of like a basketball kind of pickleball kind of send up. But yeah, I mean, basketball really took off pretty quickly. You know, just within a couple of weeks after this original game, the positives of it were immediately clocked by those in the field of, I guess, physical education. You know, they acknowledged that folks that played and that were good at it had to have, you know, certain agility and sportsmanship and hand-eye coordination and stuff. It kind of combined some things that existed in other popular sports, but it was inherently a little bit less brutish, you know?
Right. It was, there was this emphasis on agility, on teamwork, on nimbleness, as he said. And students who went to other schools would go to their own YMCAs and say, hey, we got to start playing this. You know what I mean? Rugby and face slap is for the birds. Face slap was a very popular game at the time.
Jeez. Oh, my God. Shout out to I think someone that you know as well, Gabby Watts, who's a local musician and comedian, and just launched a podcast that I think Ridiculous Historians would be a fan of. It's called American Filth, and it's like a history podcast, but it's very X-rated. It's like, and she recently did an episode on a little-known American sport called Rough and Tumble, which is basically Fight Club. It involved like eye gouging and things like that. Basically, it's like a fight to the death, but it was very popular at a time in the probably the early 1800s.
Face slap was exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I may or may not have made that up, but yeah, there are a lot of weird sports out there. And I got to say, basketball inspires a lot of very specific versions of basketball. You know, you've got people who are differently abled playing basketball.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. And then you've also got basketball where people just put their own weird rules in.
Horse. Yeah. You know? Right. And you can do one-on-one, you can do smaller teams. You know, it's a lot like, since, you know, obviously there are positions and stuff, but it's pretty nimble. Again, like I was saying earlier, not only do you have to be physically pretty nimble to like maneuver around, it's malleable. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there are different ways of doing it. And I don't think we mentioned this, but that first game that was reported on in 1892 was between students and the teachers at that particular YMCA gym. And I believe the students won 5-1. Much more interesting score than what's reported for that first ever basketball game, 1-0. But still, gosh, it seems like the teachers just got trounced. And the article in the Springfield Republican credited the teachers with having agility, but the students having science? Meaning that they were younger, I guess that their physical prowess is what led them to win?
I think it meant more that they had a better understanding of the game.
Okay.
So they knew when to pass to whom,
right? And how to position players and stuff, just because they had played more often than the teachers who were at best watching the game. So we still don't know when exactly the first intercollegiate basketball game occurred. We know that high schools began introducing it in the early 1900s. By 1905, basketball was officially recognized as the go-to winter sport. And in 1893, two college newspaper articles published separate recordings of different college basketball teams going to court with each other. So we don't know exactly who was first, but we know that it set one heck of a precedent.
Yeah, you know what we haven't really heard much of? Did Naismith, like, patent this? Did he? Is this intellectual property that's protected when you invent a game? He wrote down the rules. He pinned them to the wall. I mean, you know, technically, you can claim a copyright just by committing something to any media. You know, you can say, I wrote this song because I wrote it down first or whatever. But even if you don't file. But I'm just wondering, like, did he become a rich man off of this in his lifetime? Or
you know, that's a good question here. He definitely... In the public mind, he definitely was the father of basketball. And anytime somebody brought it up, they brought him up. But I don't know if it's like a Nike swoosh situation.
Yeah. And it's also sort of like whoever was the first that, quote, invented the fidget spinner, we don't know who that person is because either they didn't patent it or it was ununique enough that it could be done a bunch of different ways. And I think that's probably true of a game. You can't really say you can't play my game unless you pay me. That's not really how games work.
Yeah, it's just the way you would have to approach that is you could say you can't televise my game without getting me cut, or you can't hold a thing where people pay to watch you play it.
Right.
But you can't stop people from throwing a ball around.
No, I just don't get the sense that Naismith had any quote-unquote ownership over basketball, like as a trademark or as like a concept. You know what I mean?
I think he was I think he was kind of driven by the mission.
He just wanted to give it to the world.
Yeah, I think he felt really interested in spreading it. In 1898, he becomes the first official men's basketball coach at the University of Kansas. He is also at this point the only coach in the program's history to have a losing record. And while he is coaching these college students, he watches his original 13 rules evolve. Eventually, they do cut the bottoms out of the peach baskets and transform them to hoops, and free throws eventually become part of the game. 1901, dribbling is introduced, and that meant that now you can run with the ball. You just have to bounce it at the same time. Naismith originally said, look, the size of your basketball team can be anywhere from 3 to get this 40 players.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, nah, that's crazy, man. We're going to do five people on each squad. And that makes a lot more sense. The sport spreads everywhere. It goes viral, as they would say these days. You see professional leagues forming across the country. Basketball fans are cheering on their hometown teams.
So the game starts spreading like wildfire. And that conversation about the whole ownership of the sport really intrigues me, because obviously once you start getting into professional leagues, yeah, that's when there's money to be made and like endorsements to be had and all that stuff. And I was just doing a kind of a cursory Google, and it doesn't seem like Naismith like cleaned up. Like
No money during his lifetime.
He did become a coach in Kansas later, right, to hilarious effect, which we'll get to when the time is right. But this is it. This is when, you know, basketball really comes into its own. We're on the beginning, the very end of the 1800s, early 1900s, we start to see the formations of leagues in the U.S. Like the first one is the National Basketball League, which is, you know, I guess a precursor to the NBA in some ways.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, Noel, have you ever wanted to wake up to something better?
Oh, boy, have I ever, Ben.
Well, this is where Avalon Waterways comes in. How does waking up to a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, a rolling vineyard, or a charming cobblestone village sound to you?
Well, here on Ridiculous History, that's right up our street, Ben, our charming cobblestone street. So I can say it sounds pretty good to me.
You're absolutely right, Noel. Avalon Waterways has redefined cruising in so many different ways. They've got the widest opening windows. They've got beds that face the passing scenery. So wherever you go, you have a front row seat to the views of the world. And not only do you wake up in the best staterooms in the entirety of the business, but you're waking up in a new port every day, right in the heart of these amazing historic cities.
Ah, Ben, sign me up. Open your eyes to a better view and a different kind of cruising. One with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com. There were a couple of different leagues. We don't have to get too in the weeds, but just the high-level stuff. The first professional league was the NBL, National Basketball League. That was six teams up in the Northeast, and that league only lasted about 5 years. It dissolved in 1904, and then 3 decades passed until 1937, and a new league occurred, and this league had corporate support. They had Goodyear, Firestone, and General Electric footing the bills.
And it's really interesting, the National Geographic article that we sourced for this, which is behind a paywall. I'm having a hard time loading it up to get the writer credit where credit is due. But if you have a subscription, type in basketball. It's like the title is something from Peach Baskets to something that is now below a black square. But they describe it as the corporations owning the teams, like it's bigger than just they're sponsored by. These are like corporately held leagues, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, it's a new evolution for sure. And the game continued to evolve because as it became more popular, more and more people were paying attention to it and they were pointing out things that they thought could improve the rules. So not all of Naismith's ideas were winners. This is what we this is what we talked about. Some of this stuff in his head was weird. One of the rules was when the ball goes out of bounds, it's thrown into field by the first person touching it. Does that mean that you just have like 10 dudes running for this ball?
It also goes against kind of the spirit of the whole non-contact sport thing. I just picture like a cartoon where it's just a dog pile of everyone just jumping on the thing and piling on top of each other and like a, you know, swirling like dirt, kind of dust. And then you see a player crawl out of the melee and get dragged back in by their leg. That's not a winner. Eric Zimmerman, who is a professor of game design and game theory, notes. He also noted that it was unclear. The rule was very vague. And I think, did they replace this with like a tip-off or something now? Or maybe it's just... Max, help me out here. What is the sort of replacement, the modern replacement?
So now it's the last person who touched the ball, the other team gets the ball. So it's like you and me are playing against each other and you touch the ball out of bounds, I get the ball.
Oh, that makes sense. Easy penalty, right? And it changes sides.
And it incentivizes you not to knock the ball out of bounds.
Absolutely.
Which is smarter.
Absolutely.
So one example of this is... stuff like early YMCA games, the ball landed in a balcony and one team sprinted up the stairs to get it. Mm-hmm. And then two of the players on the other team boosted a third guy up so he could climb on the balcony
and get
the ball. Yeah, get the ball first. Yeah, shout out to Jack and Miles.
Mm-hmm. There was another tale of one, like a kid who strikes me as maybe one of the ones that you were sort of characterizing as like the one that would just come in, punching and swinging.
Tough home life.
Yeah, tough home life. He's got a really wicked scar. Lloyd Ware is this kid's name. And Naismith writes about this in his memoir. That this kid took, quote, great pleasure when in a jovial mood in exhibiting a scar that he got when he dived for the ball and came into contact with the sharp corner of a radiator. See, that rule to me feels like a holdover from something like rugby, you know, or like a dog pile kind of tackle situation, which again goes against the spirit of the type of game that Naismith was trying to create.
And to jump in here, like one thing that basketball and baseball and football all have that's very different than like a rugby or a soccer is there sports that, I don't know, got invented when clocks were in greater like supply. So there's pauses and goes. You watch rugby and you watch soccer, it's just constantly going.
Right.
It's a moving thing. Like soccer, they're like, oh, we don't stop in soccer. And the clock never stops.
What are you
soccer.
Saying? They were just lousy with clocks in the old days? There were just clocks falling out of the sky? This is a time where clocks were more plentiful? I don't understand.
What I'm saying is in sports like basketball, you can pause, you can stop the action. But it feels like at this point now, it feels more like a soccer or rugby where it's like you don't stop, you just keep going.
I see.
Because, the 15-minute clock probably just hit start and they just played for 15 minutes. And then if the ball rolls out of bounds, clock keeps going. Now, in basketball, you stop the clock if it goes out of bounds.
And, of course, think about it. Think about this, folks. If you were absolutely unfamiliar with basketball and you watched the first game, probably one of the weirdest things for you is going to be dribbling.
Well, it's a weird word to describe bouncing of the ball. I wonder where that came from. Would love a little bit of etymology behind dribbling. It's very visual if you think about it. It is as though the ball were some sort of fluid that is just kind of dripping out of your hand repeatedly and back up like a bead of moisture of some kind. I'm grossing myself out. But yeah, like Naismith's whole rule about not moving with the ball did not include discussion of how you could move with the ball, right?
Right.
Well, excuse me. There was no moving with the ball.
No, once you had the ball, you had to wait for someone to run to a better position.
Which is kind of dull, right? Like, I mean, it doesn't add much dynamism to the game. It doesn't add much, like, movement. It sort of cuts down on a lot of the things that make watching sports fun,
it
right?
It feels like a PE teacher game.
Right, it
like,
does.
It feels like the teacher saying, look, I've got these kids for 2 hours, and I can't let them get hurt.
Get hurt.
And I got a wicked hangover.
Yeah, exactly.
And I am so hungover.
These are madmen drinking days. You know, there he had a big old carafe of gin, you know, in his office.
Nothing else,
for
just
some reason,
gin.
Coffee. Gin and coffee mixed in together.
Yeah, exactly.
At room temperature. Oh, the place across the street, you know, folks, we're recording in the office more and more often now. The place across the street has coffee lemonade, which I've never heard of. I'm going to go try it after we record.
I want to try it.
You want to go?
I'll definitely go.
You want to go, Max?
Absolutely.
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see. Also see if it's pouring down rain still. But yeah, this was an important addition because a lot of eyes were on the game now, a lot of scrutiny, and we have now, ding, 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 corporate sponsorships, and there's a lot of money at stake. So there are certain interests in making the game as competitive and interesting to watch as possible. It's becoming a spectator sport. It's no longer relegated to the gym, you know,
right,
with the incorrigibles.
And Naismith feels like at some points he has a dark night of the soul and he wonders whether people have just taken his idea and twisted it, perverted it into something different. The idea of a player not being able to run with the ball is what he predicated the entire sport of basketball on. And it wasn't until the Yale basketball team introduced dribbling. And dribbling, you know, basically so fall and drops.
Right.
That's what dribbling
is. That's what it is. Okay. So I was barking up the right acorn.
It was a very legalistic kind of workaround because they're like, I'm holding the ball. I can't walk. Bounce. I'm walking because now I'm not holding the ball. Bounce. I'm walking. So now I'm not holding the ball.
And it may have been more of a byproduct of it, but it's also an opportunity to do some cool, fancy footwork. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
dribble
yeah.
it between your legs, sure. do little fake outs and stuff. And I mean, I don't think that was necessarily the intent. It's a good example of something that's established for a very functional reason that then becomes a sort of stylistic feature of the game that makes it a way of flexing, a way of kind of
a spectacle,
peacocking around. Yeah. That's the word.
These guys at Yale, the Yale basketball team around 1896, they referred to dribbling first as passing to themselves.
Ooh,
what a bunch of law school.
Yeah, but that makes me think of something else.
Oh, yeah. What a bunch of law school kids, though, to say that. Like, no, I'm not walking with the ball. I wasn't holding it when I stepped.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm a child. All these Yaleys in there. Mm-hmm. Their fancy shoes.
Yes.
And dapper haircuts.
Their who's who columns in the local papers.
Society pages.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And so dribbling might have ended there with just a clever loophole, right? But everybody kind of agreed. And even Naismith eventually agreed that dribbling was a really cool idea.
Oh, it is. Like you said, it led to so many other, you know, sort of byproducts. Did we mention that these Yale guys were really good? That they were sort of the top?
Yeah, they were very
good. Yeah, so I'm sort of in my head, just sort of laughing at the idea of late 1800s Yale students being the best at basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it just hadn't hit the cultural high watermark that it ultimately would. It was still very early days.
Capital shot, capital basket there, old chum.
Did they even let black people play basketball in these days?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, very racist.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not.
It took a while.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying only black people are great basketball players, but it is such an important part of like hip hop culture, shoe culture, and all of this stuff, you know, and that is really the identity that we have for it now. And it's just, you really wouldn't think of it any other way. And then it's just so white bread and dull, the early stages of basketball.
Sports have done a lot to improve the state of racial discrimination in America, which continues today, obviously, but, you know.
And they also have their issues, too.
Oh, they have huge issues.
In terms of, you know, who actually owns the teams and some of the perhaps
things that they say.
That's right. And also just the taking advantage at times of you know, young athletes and things like that. And,
like college athletes not getting paid.
Not getting paid. Yeah. And also just the fact that you can have a very lucrative career or a very like promising career and then get injured to the point of you have no backup plan. And like, it's like, you're kind of toast, you know?
Right. Your shelf life in that career can be pretty short.
Especially in college, you can get injured to the point where it ruins your prospects mm-hmm. of a professional career before you even have a chance to get paid. I think the whole not paying college students anything and even making it illegal for them to,
it's a real conspiracy.
To sell things.
Yeah.
It has been getting better.
It has. I heard it had.
Also, I wanted to cross-reference this. First black professional basketball player, first black basketball player in the NBA was Earl Lloyd. And it wasn't until, make sure I get the date right, October 31st, 1950.
Jeez,
insane.
Man.
It took a long time.
So the sport got way better in the 50s. I want to give a shout out to Naismith quote. When he came around to dribbling, he called it one of the most spectacular and exciting maneuvers in basketball. And that's the way he's going to sound now.
It's just splendiferous, I say.
Swimmingly.
The snozzberries taste like snozzberries.
Exactly.
I don't know why he's like a Willy Wonka-esque figure in my mind.
And he knew the reason he was saying dribbling was better is because he had seen other attempts to try to bring movement to the game. He said players would lose possession of the ball voluntarily, by which he means they dropped it and they would roll it somewhere. That's kind of boring to watch. Dribbling was a much more sophisticated version of this tactic. And later, people like philosopher Dr. Sean Klein would call it a subversion. Dribbling as a subversion. They were adhering to the rules, the Yaleites, but they were subverting the expectations of how those rules would be followed.
Hey, Klein, stay in your lane. Stick to talking about Plato.
Nerd.
Yeah.
Nerd.
What do you know about sport?
Yeah, you can't dribble Nietzsche, bro.
It's a subversion. That does sound like something a professor of philosophy
it sounds
would
like
say.
You guys saw that fantastic show, Kunk on Earth.
I have heard of it, and I know it's related to a really great British comedy
The guy
person.
Who wrote Black Mirror.
That's right.
The
yes,
guy
exactly.
Wrote, like,
yes.
A bunch of other
Charlie
things.
Brooker. Yeah,
yeah, that's him. You especially.
It's on Netflix now. And thank you for reminding me, because lately I have been
running dry.
In that phase where you just scroll for 45 minutes and you have subscriptions to everything, but yet there's nothing for you.
Yeah.
And it's very disheartening. We're in an age of oversaturation that yet feels like we have no options at all.
I feel it's somehow a mean statement about my intelligence. If I look on Criterion Channel, I'm like, I don't feel like watching any of these.
I do love Criterion.
I love it.
Recently, there's a great collection on there I think you'd like, Ben. It's Roger Corman directed all of these Edgar Allan Poe adaptations, because
I guess
it was just like free intellectual property, you know, because it was in the public domain. And some of them like share the same sets, like Pit and the Pendulum and Fall of the House of Usher clearly reuse some of the same spooky skeletons in the crypt, but they're like really well done. And, you know, Roger Corman, of course, was a super important creature feature kind of director.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He gave a lot of the best, biggest, you know, blockbuster directors their start. Like James Cameron, I think, worked on The Cruise with him and stuff. And, you know, he was real scrappy and kind of figured out how to make use of what he had. But those Poe adaptations are great. And there's like 10 of them. And Vincent Price is in almost every one of them.
I really appreciate that, Noel. I'm going to check those out. And when you check out Kunk on Earth, yeah. I don't want to spoil it.
I've been meaning to. And thank you for the reminder.
I'll give you a heads up because you'll like this. So Kunk talks to a lot of top-notch experts on history and very specific aspects.
Kunk is sort of like
she's like Stephen Colbert when he's doing the Colbert Report.
Okay, but it's sort of like a blank slate, kind of like figuring things out, like kind of like taking stock of what this earth is all about, or kind of
aggressive with the profound confidence of the unshakably stupid.
There you go.
Is the best way to describe Kunk as a character.
I got it.
But anyway, there's this one guy who's a philosopher that she talks to who is not enjoying the conversation, and he's hilarious. That's what I think of whenever I hear about a philosopher now. Just text me when you watch it.
I will. For some reason, when you were saying Kunk on Earth, I pictured it like a Mork and Mindy kind of situation where it's sort of like alien taking in like this absurd planet, but it does not seem like it's that at all, but it sounds amazing. So this idea of dribbling being kind of not popular to some, right?
There are always going to be, you know, some quote-unquote traditionalist or people who say, hey, that's against the rules. And they're right. It is kind of against the rules. But
he described it as amoral, though. Like this philosopher guy, Klein, he's like, he referred to the amoral underpinnings of dribbling.
Right, right, yeah. And then says, despite this, you know, more than a century after the invention of dribbling, it's safe to say basketball is better thanks to it, and points this out, which we see in so many things. Klein says, in the creation of any game, there are gaps. The players discover these ambiguities and vagueness in the rules. It's the way that the game evolves, which I think is a fair point.
No, it is. And I was mischaracterizing Klein. He wasn't saying that he was against it. He was just describing kind of the evolution of this and how, yeah, it technically was changing the rules, but it was, like he said, more flipping them a little bit and making it a little more interesting.
I'm still thinking about Klein now. I like the idea of this being Klein's primary mission in life is to stop dribbling.
Yes. Because it's amoral. No, it's good. He's like on a crusade to end dribbling. This shall not stand. Only classic basketball as Professor Naismith intended.
Exactly.
Only with peach baskets.
And they're like, all right, doctor, let's get you back to the bus.
Let's get your meds in you. Yeah.
So originally, too, let's talk about the ball. Originally,
the soccer ball, right?
Yeah, it was a soccer ball. And later, Naismith asked a former baseball pitcher named A.G. Spalding to create a ball specifically for basketball.
I've heard of him.
You have?
Or at least I've heard of the name.
Yes, you know? Yeah.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, Noel, have you ever wanted to wake up to something better?
Oh, boy, have I ever, Ben.
Well, this is where Avalon Waterways comes in. How does waking up to a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, a rolling vineyard, or a charming cobblestone village sound to you?
Well, here on Ridiculous History, that's right up our street, Ben, our charming cobblestone street. So I can say it sounds pretty good to me.
You're absolutely right, Noel. Avalon Waterways has redefined cruising in so many different ways. They've got the widest opening windows. They've got beds that face the passing scenery. So wherever you go, you have a front row seat to the views of the world. And not only do you wake up in the best staterooms in the entirety of the business, but you're waking up in a new port every day, right in the heart of these amazing historic cities.
Ah, Ben, sign me up. Open your eyes to a better view and a different kind of cruising. One with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com. It looked way different than the modern basketball today. It had sutures on it, you know,
like a medicine ball almost.
Yeah. That's a great comparison. And because it had this stitched up scar basically running down the middle of it, it affected how the ball moved. So you had to try to bounce it
on the flat parts.
Right.
Yeah. And it's funny though, because the modern basketball still does have those kind of visual seams. Like, I don't know if they're actually doing anything. It's obviously all molded, you know, and all of that.
There's
it's more of a callback.
Yeah, there's a pattern to it because it is consistently around the, you know, it's spread in a consistent design around the ball. But to your point, it does remind me of when you go to a fast food place and you can tell they put fake grill marks on the thing.
That's right.
Exactly. It feels like fake grill marks.
That's so funny, man. And I bet to your point, Ben, if you did dribble it on one of those seams, it probably would fly off willy-nilly, you know? It wouldn't be consistent. So that would probably be a little more tricky.
And that's where, that is apparently where trick dribbling comes around, the stuff you were talking about earlier.
You can make it kind of put a little English on it, make it go kind of sideways. That's cool.
So we did say that Naismith came around to dribbling. He became a dribbling fanboy, but make no mistake, he didn't love all the changes into his sport. After he stopped coaching, he watched a contest in 1910 between Kansas and Missouri, and he freaked out. He said, "They're killing my game." He said, "The referees need to be more authoritative." He said, "You know, this game is full of fouls. I made rules for there not to be fouls." And he was irritated with it. And then, to your point about corporate America, just 1 year later, 1911, he published an editorial talking about the problem of, quote, commercialization in sports.
Oof. Yeah, I think that ship has sailed, bro.
even then.
Like what we were talking about earlier with Max, like, how, you know, now it's just, they're just squishing the game. Talk about making the rules malleable for the wrong reasons, you know, to like fit in more advertisements. I mean, this is definitely the early stages of the utter corporatization and commercialization of sports.
Yeah, he said, look, you need to keep money out of college basketball. I hate the idea of, quote, the worship of the dollar in the field of athletics. And then he gets a little highfalutin here. I'm on his side, but he gets highfalutin. He says he's invented his game to be a, quote, a laboratory in which the great moral lessons of fair play and the square deal are taught. Again,
cool idea,
but weird.
Some truth to that. It is a good, you know, it is certainly, if you're young and you're learning to play basketball, it's a community building thing. It's a way of making friends. You know, if you're playing in college or in high school, even like you're in the trenches with these people. You are learning how to think of others, you know, and not just yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying what he's saying though is more about the, I don't know, I guess kind of the idealistic version of what the sport is.
He's kind of drinking his own flavor.
He definitely is. No question about it. And he's going to go on to drink some even more oddly flavored AIDS later. We're going to get to that for sure. But again, that ship has sailed. This guy, it is out of his hands now. Like, truly. He is past the ball.
Ah, there it is.
Whether by choice or just, again, it's just what happened.
Just history.
An idea is, you can't really own it at the end of the day, especially you can say I created this or like I made this, but it's like with a work of art, you know, once people are interpreting it and looking at it and then enjoying it and making it part of their lives, then it's no longer even, it doesn't even belong to the artist anymore.
And if it's a good idea, then should it not belong to everyone?
And should you not be able to improve it? That's another thing though that makes it different than say Van Gogh going back and touching up his paintings. Like this is an idea and it's a little bit fluid, but then you start to get into these debates whether it's like, you know, strict constructionist kind of views of a sport.
It's funny you say that because I was I went to the Prado, you know, when I was traveling a while back, and they've got a bunch of Picasso stuff, and I heard this amazing conversation from two people. I'm still trying to figure out what exactly their relationship was, but it's like it was this older guy and this kid. And the kid is pretty young, maybe 8 or 10. I don't think the older guy was his father from the way they talked to each other.
Okay.
Because the dad, they're staring at the huge Picasso painting, which is the bullfight thing.
Yeah.
I can't remember the
Guernica?
Name. Yeah, I think you're right.
The big one.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So they're staring at it. And it's kind of slow because we're there on a weekday morning. And in Spanish, the older guy is saying, "What's the big deal about this? It's not impressive." You know, as a matter of fact, I could do this. And then the
never
kid
heard that one before.
Right. And then the kid looks up without missing a beat and he goes, yeah, but you didn't, you won't, and you never will. And I was like, I don't think that's your dad.
Game, set, match? How does that go?
That's like, great. No one can well knock
game,
it down
set,
like
match. You're correct. That's okay. Tennis.
Good.
But, yeah, you got it.
Cool. I know from sports.
There you go.
Don't forget love.
It's right. What makes a Subaru a Subaru.
I was thinking of the interstate gas station, which is a cool one.
Yeah, it's no Buc-ee's.
But who is?
Oh, nothing sadder than a Love's across the street from a Buc-ee's. It's like, y'all, just this is not going to go well for
you. Comes with tumbleweeds.
Oh, it's sad.
So the sport was going to undergo this kind of transformation. Yeah. As soon as it got popular, dribbling probably saved basketball, to be honest with you.
No question.
And this goes to something that you were talking about at the very beginning when we started this series this week. Basketball is something that is continuing to evolve. Colleen Macklin, in conversation with author Nick Green, Colleen Macklin says, games are a democratic art form. The beauty of a physical game is that you don't have to be a programmer or an artist to make changes. The rules are modified and tweaked and then played by regular humans. So it's kind of like crowdsourcing.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And again, the art comparison, it's a tricky one because, you know, sure, art belongs to the public, but also you're not going to go back and change a work of art. Like, that would be considered black, unless you're like George Lucas, in which case you shouldn't do that, one might argue. But with basketball or any sport, or like, hell, the Constitution, it's designed to be somewhat fluid and living so that it can change with the times. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
To varying degrees of success. But I would argue and agree with you that dribbling was an incredibly important innovation in the sport.
And that's where it verges into something poetic, because Nick Green says, basketball is the only major sport that can be traced to a single person, but that person's most important contribution was that he relinquished control of his invention. And so he built the car and he let other people drive it and decide where it would go, you know? And there's something poetic to that. It's still a work in progress, as you said, and it's gone far beyond just keeping a bunch of rowdy kids from beating the snot out of each other.
You know, sometimes we save these tangents and trivia bits for like our new kind of clip show concept and we're starting to do, but I think that some of these would be a great way to wrap this one up.
Yeah.
Just we've kind of been hinting at some of Nate Smith's sort of odder proclivities, and also the fact that despite having invented the game, he only ever played it twice.
Yeah,
and like, there, you know, some of the images of him in his early days are hilarious. Like, there's one where it's like him and this like old like kind of washerwoman looking type figure.
Kobe, was not,
and he's holding the basket up, and she's just got this like really it's a soccer ball, really really funny. But yeah, only played it twice. His team in one of those games, the teachers at the YMCA lost 5-1. So he played in that original game. That's the 5-1 game that we were talking about.
Yeah.
The one that was for public consumption. And the 1 point for his team that was scored in that game was by his pal, a guy named A.A. Stagg, who was kind of the inventor of American football.
And and It's interesting how these stories coincide, because Naismith, along with his spouse, Maud Naismith, they invented an early version of the football helmet to help out Stagg, and their early version was flannel.
It makes me think of like the Pete and Pete hat, you know, like the kind of, what do they call that, a deer stalker hat or whatever, but like the flannel, classic red and black, you know, checkered kind of pattern. It was made to prevent something called cauliflower ear, which is a condition that happens when you get bashed in the ear repeatedly, and it starts to kind of swell up and then stays that way.
Yeah, and this is strange, because he also had beef with coaches. Even though he himself was a coach at University of Kansas for a while, he thought
coach. Right? He had a bad record, losing record,
mm-hmm. because he thought coaches basically shouldn't do their job.
Oh.
He said, if you're a coach who micromanages your players by telling them what to do while they're on the court,
it's like cheating, kind of tantamount, huh?
You're evil.
Whoa.
So he was way
worse
more
than evil.
He was way more like, I think, a Ted Lasso, where he's like, come on, guys, you know, basketball's a lot like falling in love.
Stop falling in love. It's like going on a magical journey with your best friend and being a goldfish.
Now, you just get out there, you be a dog with peanut butter.
That's right. You have a good old time. No, but all that tracks, though, doesn't it? It's philosophically, he's still stuck in the gym trying to get these horny teenagers to chill out. You know, all of this other stuff is sort of against his whole philosophy of the game. And I was saying earlier, it almost sounds like he thought telling them what to do was cheating or something. It was like depriving them of the part that actually matters, where they figure it out themselves.
Ah, yes. And that is a good point. It is an aesthetic, philosophical point. We also know, and maybe this is our wrap, because I know we're all three excited about this. What happened to Naismith after basketball, after coaching? If you look at Rob Rain's biography of our buddy James, you find that he spent his years after coaching working on medical experiments. This is a true story.
Like a John Harvey Kellogg type figure.
He got deep into this.
Yeah. Bet he was really into enemas. But, you know, he invented or was developing something called a sobriety tester, which I imagine must have been some early form of breathalyzer, kind of. I mean, they didn't really go any further than that. He also had all of these notions about what testing people to see if they had natural athletic abilities. And the test that he developed is bonkers.
Oh, yeah. So this is a true story again. He would blindfold his students or his patients, right, his subjects. He would clog up their ears. He would put them in the driver's seat of a car and see if they could sustain a speed of 35 miles an hour.
Doesn't that just mean that they're like loose cannons and kind of insane? What does that have to do with anything? It doesn't even involve coordination.
What does the
can't
test
see.
Tell you? He says, if you do that, you've got a great kinesthetic sense. And it's like, thank you. I'm glad no one died.
No joke. Hopefully they were doing it in like an abandoned parking lot or some sort of test track. But again, he was not a rich man. I'm not sure where he would have conducted these
tests. He wasn't even a good driver.
No, he hated driving. That's right. And then the last one, I think, which is maybe what we've been hinting at, he invented this like stretcher machine for children to like help them grow taller. Well, you know, for anybody, it didn't have to be for children, just for short kings and queens out there. And he was interviewed about this device by a school newspaper. And he said that babies between the ages of 5 months and 1 year should be given a good stretching.
Oh, cool. Tight.
But there was something that he was a little concerned about. He did have something that he hadn't quite figured out yet.
My torture rack is so effective that the children may never stop growing.
Indefinitely.
These string bean giants have ruined basketball.
Yeah. The playing field has no longer been leveled. The very playing field has been leveled. The other kind destroyed by this device. But what a guy, man. I'm really, this is such an interesting story. Despite all of the inherent racism, obviously, that I wouldn't say we glossed over. Mm-hmm. I think we addressed it just.
What a week, too. And we're not even done because we may come back to this.
I think there's more because, again, we haven't even gotten into the modern era and all of the, you know, again, we've hinted at it, but the tie-ins to fashion and music and, I mean, just the level of stardom that is achieved by, you know, some of these individuals. It's almost like to me, I don't know about you, but doesn't it feel like basketball is kind of the star maker sport, more so even than baseball? Household name-y kind of at this point.
For us, in pop culture, basketball, like very, very well-known athletes achieve a level of fame that transcends the sport itself.
That's what I'm getting at. And you nailed it.
I would say of the sports, basketball is the one where one person can take over the game a lot more. And in baseball, you can go like 4-for-4 with 3 home runs and your team loses. Football, you like a quarterback can be really good, but like, you know, Michael Jordan, LeBron James, like these guys,
it's a star maker, like on the by the nature of the very nature of the sport,
right? Like how it's played too is in a lot of systems. Like, you know, our local team, the Atlanta Hawks, is the offense goes through Trae Young, and he runs it, so that person can sometimes get because they're kind of like, you know, the point guard, they're running the whole thing. So they get the attention focused on them, which, you know,
doesn't people, that also mean, though, that it could be cheating, more conducive to fixing games and cheating?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yo, yeah.
And if you have inside information that a player's not going to be there or something like that, or you could make bets accordingly.
I mean,
you know?
Early 2000s, I'm forgetting his name off the top of my head. My buddy Kevin would be very disappointed, but there was an NBA ref who got thrown in prison for fixing
NBA talked about
games.
Him. Yeah. And it was easy to do because he'd kind of do it like death by a thousand cuts, like little calls, little inaccurate calls that nobody could even notice.
Those are so subjective. I mean, also, I want to...
Scott Foster? I don't think Chris Paul has ever won a playoff game with this guy.
Shout out to Brian Tuohy.
That's right. That was the guy about, you know, he believes all sports are rigged.
And also, gather ye Spaldings while ye may. I posit to you that basketball is in its heyday until sumo wrestling becomes more normalized.
That is a hot take, Ben.
Now I can't wait to see sumo wrestling.
Sumo
is
still very popular in Japan, right? I mean, like, it's super hugely popular. Yeah.
There's also a huge organized crime element to it.
Totally.
Because, you know, it's fixing sports, right?
I always really liked E. Honda in Street Fighter 2.
E. Honda's dope.
Yeah, he always fought in, like, the weird Japanese bathhouse, you know? And he had the cool torpedo move and the slap. He did a good 100-hand slap. Good animation on that.
I was so disappointed because I thought I was going to go see a sumo match, but they're really expensive.
Really?
They're really expensive. And then I thought, I was talking to a friend, and I was like, well, what are we paying for here? For equipment or something like that? And he goes, man, it might just be for, you know, the upkeep of the sumo.
Yeah, massages and stuff, barley.
I mean, because they might look like they might look like they're not in shape.
Oh, no, it's a different kind of in shape, right?
It's
like competitive eaters, you know? Yeah. I bet you, too, I mean, maybe you saw this. I bet you that there are, like, sumo stars, just like there are basketball stars, you know?
And
I
then
mean, there's an individual kind of thing.
Like, go into business, like how Shaq owns the Krispy Kreme here in town. They own stuff, you know, you'll be walking by a restaurant and then you'll see a picture of a sumo guy who's just like,
big thumb, you know, boom.
I'm into noodles now.
That makes sense.
We hope we delivered, folks, on what we're saying in part one of this series, which is that even if you yourself don't tune into every basketball game, there's a lot to learn.
Oh, man. No, the history of it is so interesting. And, you know, it also being one of only two uniquely American sports, you know, which is kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And speaking of big deals, we want to thank you for tuning in, folks. We also want to thank some of the big deals on our show, our research associate, Doc Z, of course, super producer, Max Williams. And I don't know if he deserves it, but I'm still going to thank Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. the Quizster, even though he high-roaded the heck out of us.
Didn't he?
He's in the office
now. You think I didn't see him?
He's using the biggest and nicest studio for himself.
I caught a glint out of the corner of my eye, and it was the light reflecting off his bald head.
He's also in the studio that does not have blinds yet and everyone can stare at him.
Exactly. So
he did that on purpose.
Almost knocked me down.
He's in the zoo. We're in the one with the best AC.
Speaking of the zoo, if anyone's going to be in Las Vegas next week for the iHeart Music Festival, your boys Ben Bolin and Noel Brown will be podcasting in something of a human zoo type scenario.
Finally.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a booth of some sort that we will be housed in. I hope there's snacks.
I do too.
I think there's air conditioning, but it is as part of like a Bose promotion of some kind, which I love. Bose
rules. Bose is great.
And not getting paid to say that. I love their products. But you can come and put on headphones and observe us like reptiles in a reptile house or something, you know?
Yeah, I don't. Word is still out on whether or not you can feed us, but you know, be the change, just like James Naismith.
Exactly. But we'll be there on Friday doing Ridiculous History and also Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Mm-hmm. In addition to several other podcasts that are in our kind of OG stuff kind of network family.
You know who else is going to be there?
Who?
Jonathan.
Yeah, that's right. You know who else is going to be there? Lenny Kravitz.
Oh, yeah. TLC.
Sheryl Crow.
Lil Wayne.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of people.
Travis Scott, who's apparently quite popular.
Yeah.
I'm stoked about Sheryl Crow. I'm actually genuinely kind of dig Sheryl Crow. Remember, didn't we have a fake beef with Sheryl Crow back in the day?
She knows what she did.
Okay, fair. Maybe we can address it. We can squash the beef or set it on fire.
She just pushes people.
I know. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.